Woody joins us now. Woody, thanks for your time for a past champions chat here. You were 49, as Damon mentioned, when you won the Sanderson back in 2013. In this game, when you're playing well, I suppose you never think you're going to play badly again. But at 49 back then, would you have lifted that trophy and thought this is probably the last one? Or would you have continued to believe you still had more in you?
Well, I mean, obviously that late, as far as on the regular tour, you don't know, you know, how much you have left. But, it was one of those rarities where I played so good that it didn't matter that I didn't make that many putts that week. And I was able to overcome my shortcoming. And, if you look back on it, I did something that is very rare in golf, and that is to win a golf tournament and not be in the top 10 in putting for the week. And that's part of the reason why I only won four times. It's really hard, especially in today's game. Today's game, it's basically impossible to outplay the field that well from tee to green and still win. So, from that standpoint, yeah, it was there's a reason why there's such a big gap between victories, is because it's really hard to play that well and beat that many people without, you know, being the best putter that week like it is nowadays.
Woody, you mentioned your four wins on the PGA Tour, also four wins on PGA Tour champions, famously battled Tiger down the stretch in the 07 PGA Championship. Having covered you for a long time, you could run hot and can run hot from time to time. Does that heat help you? Does it provide you something? Or would you say that those implosions, those mini eruptions from time to time, hurt what you were trying to do?
I think that's a misnomer or a double-edged sword. If you look at anything I did, I never got mad at the golf course. I never got mad at a volunteer. I never yelled at my caddy. I never blamed anything on the gallery. Everything was internal. And if I didn't have that fire, if I didn't push myself that hard, I would have never made it on tour to begin with after my injuries out of college. I mean, I was a 31-year-old rookie. I mean, I would have given up. I worked in a bank for 8 years. How many people have worked in a bank for 8 years, not played competitive golf, and still push themselves to make it now I've had a 30-year career?
You're 60 years old now, Woody. You're still playing a full schedule on the PGA Tour Champions. Is that fire still there? Do you still enjoy it as much as you did in your peak years?
Oh, the fire's still there. Unfortunately, the game isn't. You know, as the body doesn't allow you to be as consistent. And, you know, like I said, my biggest attribute was ball striking, and my ball striking's not nearly as well as it used to be. It comes and goes, but for me to play three rounds in a row, you know, the way I used to is very difficult. But I can still play. I still hit it just as good as anybody. The problem is still always the same as it's always been. And it's just gotten worse as age has, you know, kicked up on me, to where that I can't hide it as well as I did on the regular tour with my ball strike.
Woody, I'm just back from Montreal, and Royal Montreal in particular. We must have played your highlights as the Aquaman moment on 14 about 100 times. Your name came up. I walked by the water side. I read a story that you were lobbying Jim Furyk, and you're at the Furyk and Friends event right now, to be a vice captain and return to Royal Montreal. Can you confirm, and if so, why were you lobbying him?
Absolutely. I lobbied him all year last year when he became captain. I felt as though, you know, all that I did that week and what have you, I felt like I actually, to a point, deserved to be there. I felt like I'd be a great asset there. Because there was so many positives and so many things that happened there that I could, you know, relate to the guys and what have you about what was going on that week. And I felt as though I, you know, it's not like I would have been there and people wouldn't have understood why I was there. I felt as though I would have brought something different. And I definitely lobbied him as hard as I could.
17 years later, I mean, we still talk about the goggles in Aquaman, the fact that Barbara Nicklaus was the one who brought you the goggles. Are you comfortable that that's what you're known for, as opposed to maybe the 8 birdies that you made and the quality of your golf that week and that year?
Yeah, that's the disappointing part. So that's at least the one nice thing that they finally did this year, was at least show that I birdied the last three for the halve and that I did make eight birdies. You know, my partner only made one. I'm glad that they showed that, you know, I did play well. I tell the people all the time, the ones that give me a hard time about it, I tell them, I said, you can give me a hard time because I'm not afraid to laugh at myself. You can give me a hard time if you can tell me what I did after that. And it's amazing how nobody knows what I did after that. And that's why I tell them, I said, well, you can't give me a hard time if you don't know that I birdied the last three for a half.
Woody, the U.S. hadn't lost the President's Cup for 9 years before you had that moment in Montreal. Hasn't lost in the 17 years since then. Do you think any kind of change or tweak is needed to make the President's Cup a little more competitively relevant?
I don't know how they could tweak it, to be totally honest with you. The problem, I think, is the fact that, you know, the U.S. Tour is and always will be the best tour in the world. And it's going to have the most top, you know, 50 players. So, and the fact that they get to play every year, you know, between the President's Cup and the Ryder Cup, they're playing every year. So you're getting guys that are not only the best in the world, but they're also playing this event, basically the same kind of event, year after year after year. And then you get the Ryder Cup, and then you get the internationals are only playing it every couple years. So you're asking these guys that really, you know, don't have the experience or aren't, you know, let's just say the top 50 in the world, to go up against guys that are the top 50 in the world and play every single year. That's a tough task. So I don't know how they can change the criteria. It's just always going to be an uphill battle for them.
Woody, you talked about your unique path to the game, working at a bank for 8 years, a rookie on tour in your 30s. When you look at the current game, the modern game, how connected are you to it? Do you watch the current PGA Tour? Are you concerned about the state of play in professional golf as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't watch the men's game that much because to me, it doesn't remind me of golf when the way I learned how to play the game. I actually watch the LPGA a hell of a lot more because to me, it's still the true essence of golf. The men's game has changed so much with the technology and stuff that they've put everybody in a giant fishbowl. So everybody's in a giant fishbowl every week, and the best putter wins. The best guy pops out. Now, right now, you've got Scottie Scheffler on a run that's, you know, kind of Tiger-esque in its own way. But other than that, everybody just pops in and out, in and out, in and out, because there's no way to separate the players anymore. What made Tiger so great is he hit shots that other players can't hit, that he was ahead of the curve. Nowadays, there's not one shot that not one player on tour can't hit. They all hit the same shots. So there's no way to separate from one player to the next other than putting. And I think that's sad because I think there's some really good players. I mean, I think some guys are unbelievably talented. But you can't show that difference anymore because the other guy, if he's on that week, he still knocks you in the teeth.
When you talk about watching the LPGA Tour as more the true essence of the game and then the lack of real separation or distinction in the men's game, Woody, do you believe that the men's players are then worth what they currently seem to believe they are worth in terms of how much growth and the perception of greed has taken over the men's game?
I think that's, again, a sad reality. I think in any sport and anything in our society, if you get people that think they're worth a hell of a lot more than they are and that they're bigger than the game itself. And now, unfortunately, with the LIV situation and what Norman has done, you now have the upper echelon of our tour thinking that they deserve so much because they're there and that they stayed. And that's ruining the bottom part of the game. There should not be a two-headed tour. And right now you now have a two-headed PGA Tour. And I think that's sad. I really do. There should never be a separation You can sit there and say you're the best player in the world and you can be number one, but you should not be separate from the other guy that's still playing and playing well and keeping the tour apart. I want to say Paul Goydo said it best. You have a cherry pie, right? And the cherries might be the ultimate goal. You know, they taste the best, but without the crust, you don't have the cherry pie.
Do you think that's a commonly held perception among your veteran peers on the Champions Tour, that the generation that is currently dominant on the PGA Tour has lost perspective of their own worth, but even kind of lost a sense of who built it before them and who comes after them?
I do. I definitely do. I think, again, I'm not saying nobody's worth what, you know, when you're playing well and you're winning, but when you're demanding more from, let's go to the tournament themselves. If you're in a big market, it's nothing for you to add a little bit. But if you're in a smaller market tournament, let's just say this week in Mississippi, it's the Sanderson Farms, and you're going to them and saying, guess what, guys, you got to up your purse $1 million. Otherwise, guys aren't going to play because they don't feel as though they deserve to play for only X million dollars and play for a $2 million first prize. They think it's wrong for them to have to play for only $1 million. I mean, I think that's ridiculous.
To that point, Woody, how important is a week like where you are in Jacksonville at the Constellation, Furyk and Friends, where charity is kind of, you know, front and center, first, second and third on the billboard this week?
Absolutely. Like I said, one of the greatest things of the PGA Tour and one of the things that was always our hallmark is how much we have donated to where we're at. You know, all the donation money that we give to all the charities at each event, that should be the most important thing. And that's part of also the Pro-Am situation. You know, there a couple years ago, you had guys that would always skip the Wednesday Pro-Am, say that they had a, you know, their old aching injury, you know, bothered them here and there. And so then they'd skip the Wednesday Pro-Am, but then they'd play Thursday and Friday, you know, because they just didn't want to play in the Pro-Am. And they've forgotten the fact that the Pro-Am is what started all this charitable donation and money for all the charities in the area. And like I said, it snowballed from there in that, you know, they didn't want to play in the Pro-Ams. Now they feel as though they deserve more, you know, in each tournament. And like I said, through time, every sport has grown and players get paid more than in the era before. But when you force the powers that be to give you more than what they ultimately can and have to sacrifice the bottom half or the true core of the tour, I think that's wrong. And that's where, and unfortunately, that's where the tour has gotten these last few years.
A lot of stuff has changed, I guess, since you first came out on tour. Woody, you know, you never had an entourage around you. You see that on the tour these days, everyone has, you know, the caddies there, the swing coaches there, the putting coaches there. There's a guy to hold the track man, the nutritionist, the personal trainer. They're all there. Do you think that kind of makes it a little more difficult to exist or to own your game as a tour pro these days versus when you were out there?
Oh, without a doubt. There's no doubt. I mean, if you watch, it's amazing how many great players can't play without talking to their coach or without trying to figure. Nobody knows how to figure their own game out anymore. My God, it's crazy. I cannot imagine being on the range with, you know, hitting balls and there's 20 teachers and instructors and on the range watching, you know, somebody hit balls because the ball's going a little right for them right now. And like I said, therein lies the difficulty and the problem that I was talking about earlier. What made Tiger so good? Tiger didn't have to have Hank Haney or Butch or anybody on his hip. He was good enough and understood his swing that he, you know, each week he could get through it. Now, if he was struggling for a long period of time, then you fly and you go see your instructor and that's fine. But you don't need to be there every single week because you should understand what your golf swing does, what the ball does, And therein lies the difficult, the problem with today's technology is these guys don't know what the difference is, because all they're really worried about is, do I hit it far enough? Is my swing speed fast enough? Is my ball speed high enough? And, oh, did I knock it in the hole?
You know what, Woody, it's always great to visit with you. And I knew you made three straight birdies to get that half against Immelman in Sabatini. Have a great week in the First Coast, and we'll talk to you soon, Woody.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
For more on today's action, we say hello to Emilia Migliaccio, who will be part of the call today right here on Golf Channel. Great to see you as always. As we look ahead to day two coverage, what stands out about this leaderboard?
This leaderboard is so exciting. You have the men's side. LSU is at 3 under, Mississippi State at 1, starting day one, beginning into day two. But it's windy, and you have the eight other teams are within 6 shots of the lead. So it is so tight, or 6 shots of third place. BYU started the day at 10 over. It is super tight and very exciting. The women's side, Arkansas starting the second round, they're kind of sweeping it away. But it's really tight coming down the leaderboard as well. This golf course is windy and difficult. Literally anything can happen here at Blessings Golf Club, and I can't wait to call some action later today.
Amelia, when you said the golf course is difficult, that might be an understatement. There were only two teams on either side yesterday, men's or women's, who got either under par or anywhere close to par. Just how difficult is it out there?
What's most difficult about this golf course is how intimidating it looks off the tee. There's penalty area everywhere. The bunkers are so well positioned. So even though there's a lot of fairway when you get down to your ball, it looks so narrow off the tee. That's really the key, to be able to pick your targets and swing with confidence, which is so hard to do, especially if the wind picks up. There's also a lot of undulations on the greens. The long hitters definitely have the advantage, because if they can get over all the trouble, they'll have much shorter clubs in. But to be able to do that, you got to swing your driver with a whole lot of confidence, which can be really hard to do out here at Blessings.
Well, Amelia, you're a wonderful player in your own right. You appreciate great golf. Who are you most looking forward to watching today?
Oh, there's so many things I'm looking forward to, particularly the hole location on 8 today. It's a short little narrow par 3, playing just under 135 yards. But it's in a hole location today where someone could make an ace. It's sitting in the front, and there's some slopes behind the hole. Someone actually made an ace yesterday already, so I feel like we're going to be seeing a lot of close shots. But just the talent and the level of play that we see out of these teams is just really impressive with how difficult the golf course is. I'm most looking forward to seeing how these players can adapt to some of the carnage out there, which happens all the time out here on this golf course. It's just going to be a really fun test and prepares all of these teams for the rest of the season.
And we are still very early in the season, Amelia. A lot of the attention goes on the NCAAs later in the year. What do you look to get out of this portion of the season in the fall as a player?
Oh, there's so much to get out of. Particularly as a player, I would love the fact that my coach can watch me hit every single shot. So if I'm struggling with something, or if I was working on my irons or wedges coming into this tournament, they get to see everything that I do. And then it's such a springboard for the team on how to get better going forward. It's also such a tough test. So then every other golf course feels that much easier and gives you the confidence to play well and score. So I love this golf course for these teams and the preparation for postseason.
Amelia, thanks for the time. We'll speak to you soon.
Yes, thank you so much. Enjoy it as always.
Our colleague John Wood was out there in Montreal all week, and he joins us now. Seems like only yesterday we were taking a car to the airport. Maybe that was yesterday. It's great to see you, pal. Listen, some people are saying fix the President's Cup, change the format, bring in LPGA players. I thought it was awesome. I say leave it alone. What say you?
I say leave it alone as well. And I'll tell you this. I spoke with Trevor Immelman at one point, and he told me and really, you know, expressed how much they love this event. And they want to figure out a way to win it. They don't want to change the rules to try and wait, you know, to win it. The final score was a, you know, significant win for the United States, but it was way closer than the final score was. And you mentioned Korea could have gone either way, came down to the very last match. Same thing down in Melbourne. Really, they dominated for the first two sessions. And had they been able to close that out a little more, they would have won there. I will say this. I think what will really fix, you know, the President's Cup and make it extremely competitive is if we can get a PIF deal done and those guys are allowed back, because they lost a big chunk. Joaquin Niemann, Abe Ancer, Oosthuizen, they lost a big chunk of their core. So I think if that deal can somehow get done and those guys can come back and play for the international squad, I don't think they need to do anything to it.
It is worth noting, I suppose, that the two international soil matches that were really close were on the other side of the world, and as opposed to 30 miles from the New York State border here, John. What do you assess of Mike Weir's decision-making, specifically doubling down on partnerships that had lost on Saturday morning and icing Minwoo Lee after the Thursday morning all the way to the singles?
Yeah, hindsight's always 20/20, of course, but... he had a plan. I was surprised that he sent the same four teams out Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon, because I think they lost that session 3-1. So it wasn't like they were playing great or dominating. You had some fresh players. I thought Ben On should have been out there. I saw him play one match and he played beautifully. It obviously, like I said, hindsight's 20/20, and I honestly didn't think much of his Friday pairings, and then he goes out, they go out and go 5-0. So it's tough to say, but I've never seen it where you send the four same teams out Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon in different formats. I thought there were some fresher players that could have been out there.
Woody, you got an interesting role as the Ryder Cup team manager for the United States. You were on the ground every day last week. I was struck by the camaraderie of the U.S. team. They really seem to get along and want to pull all in the same direction. Are there things that you can take from being on the ground as a walker that will help you next year at Bethpage as team manager?
I think so. And Keegan is going to know way more about that than I will, because he was in the team room all week. And we're going to talk next week about everything that he learned and things that he wants to implement. But I think the one thing is really stress. Give them one reason why they should be together. And whether that's a bulletin board material or the golf course, or I don't think you need to give them a whole lot, because they do love each other. It's a different generation. They compete every week, but they enjoy each other's company. And I think we'll see more of that at Bethpage. And I don't think that we're going to need to change too much from what Jim Furyk did. And Keegan has his own ideas on some things I'm sure he'll tweak. But he told me right after he got the clinching point, he said, we're going to do a lot of the same things next year.
You mentioned earlier, John, that having LIV players come back to the President's Cup might actually be the change that's necessary. It's very easy to say and very obvious that LIV has sort of diminished the international team's caliber. Has it also made things easier for the U.S. team? Because there are a few difficult locker room personalities that disappeared to LIV that you don't really have to worry about, and you're not going to have to worry about next year at Bethpage, probably.
They are eligible to play, yeah, at Bethpage. Obviously the talent that you lose, you kind of have to decide, is it worth losing that talent for maybe an easier, you know, camaraderie amongst the teammates? And I know what you're saying, but I think when guys get in the same room, they're gonna get along just fine. Whether it's, you know, Bryson DeChambeau or Brooks Koepka, Dustin Johnson, I think once they're in the room together, I think any squabbles or headaches that you might anticipate will be gone. The USA, the thing that's so great for the U.S. team right now is they are so deep. You think about the players that went to LIV that, you know, haven't played on, weren't on this team. And the team is still fantastic. I mean, the whole team was in the top 25. So if it happens, great. If it doesn't, I don't think it's a big deal, because the U.S. is so deep right now.
Woody, I was struck by how intense the players were, you know, interviewing them seconds after their match ended, as opposed to interviewing someone on a Friday after a round in Palm Beach. Do the caddies get involved in that as well? I mean, obviously we saw what happened last year in Rome, but are the caddies as amped up, you know, day to day in a President's Cup or Ryder Cup? Because it just seems like a completely different animal. I'd never had that role before of interviewing the players seconds after the match was completed.
I would say, if anything, I think the caddies are more amped up, but they are not allowed to show it because they have to keep their player calm. But in those team rooms before matches, it is very intense amongst the caddies. We are trying to get everything right. We're talking over everything. But once the flag goes up, we need to be that steadying influence out there. We can't be up and down throughout a match. And it's a team event, yes, but also match play. Match play really is a different animal because every hole is basically a small tournament and every day is a point. So it's a different, it is much more intense from the get-go than a regular 72-hole stroke play tournament because literally from the first hole on, you are winning points, period. So that's a different animal, but the caddies are, they love it every bit as much as the players. And once the matches are over, they'll let it out. But while they're going on, they need to, be the standing influence because things can get really emotional out there.
Paul McGinley made a really good point on Live From on Sunday night, John, about how data is overplayed to some extent in team events and that it ought to be a guidance and not become a rule. I'm curious where you are on that. What is the balance in your mind between the stats and just simply the vibes of a good team?
I think the stats are useful. They're a tool like anything else, but you cannot forgo your gut. Joe Maddon, the great baseball manager, talks about if you have a gut feeling, do it. Because it's a lifetime of experiences that are telling you that. It's not a whim. There is something in you that trusts your gut. And like I said, you can use the statistics and the analytics as a tool. And I'll tell you a great example. The analytics at Whistling Straits told Steve Stricker, do not play Colin Morikawa and DJ, Dustin Johnson, together. And they went 3-0, and I don't think they got to the 16th hole. So that was a case of Steve Stricker looking at the analytics and going, I don't agree with that. I think they're going to make a great team, sent them out together, and they dominated. So I think it's important not to use them as a crutch, not to use them completely. If it doesn't work, using that as a crutch and just using it as the excuse to say, well, the analytics said we should do it, so we did it. You have to have your own mind. You have to have your own gut instincts. And that's a great example of it. I've seen baseball managers just go completely analytics. And I wonder why they even have a manager, because if they're going to go analytics, just use the computer. Why pay a manager? So I think it's like you said, it's a tool. It can't be everything.
Keegan Bradley, 2-1 last week, clinching point for the U.S. Emotional. Wears his heart on his sleeve, still playing well. Can he captain and play next year? Is your role as manager there just in case he continues to play well and wants to somehow carry the walkie-talkie and 14 clubs besides?
I think he can definitely do that. Obviously, it's a big job, but he's already named two amazing assistant captains. He'll name two more in the coming year. And he's been, when he first got named, we talked and I said, hey, I'm not going to bring anything to you at golf tournaments. You're preparing, you're playing golf, and we'll talk about things on weeks off. And he said, Woody, I can handle it. If you got something you need to talk about, bring it to me. And I would bet you right now, if you ask the other 11 players on that President's Cup team, if they'd want to see Keegan as a playing captain next year, I would think you'd have a unanimous vote. I just think he's emotionally so strong. He loves it. He's passionate about it. And I think it would be something unique. We haven't had it for so long. I think if he's close, if he makes it on points, obviously he's going to play. And I think if he's close, he will go to the team, the guys who have made it and the captain's picks he's going to take and say, give me your vote. Do you want me or don't you? And I think for the most part, they would love to have him on the team. And between, whatever position I have there during the week and the assistant managers, we can give him the information he needs without overwhelming him if he's playing.
All roads lead to Bethpage State Park on the LIE 1 year from now. Enjoy some downtime, Woody. Thanks for a few minutes.
Thank you, guys. I always enjoy coming on.
Kevin Velo. He's finished inside the top 30 in the season-long points race earlier this year. He earned his first career victory on the Corn Ferry Tour with his win in the Astara Golf Championship. And Kevin joins us now. Kevin, congratulations on getting your card. Your win was pretty early in the season. Did you feel as though you could breathe a little easier then, knowing that you'd probably done enough to get the card? Or at what point in the year did you get to the breathe easy stage?
After I won, it almost felt like I needed to work a little bit harder. because I didn't want to be one of those guys who won and then didn't earn their card. I started to breathe easy after our event in Norman, Oklahoma at OU's golf course. That 11th place finish after back-to-back fourth place finishes got me over the 1,000-point threshold, and that's kind of where I was able to take a big deep breath and kind of soak it all in.
You haven't been able to breathe easy a lot during your career. I read where you got offered one book scholarship from San Jose State. My mom went to San Jose State, by the way. And you said, had you not gotten that, you might not be playing golf today. If you had not gotten that offer, what would you be doing today?
Probably working some marketing job. I have honestly no idea. John Kennedy at San Jose State was generous enough to give me that scholarship just so I can sign a letter of intent back then. And it was a wild ride there. I mean, got better every year, but without JK and that opportunity, I definitely would not be where I'm at right now.
You turned professional, began your career kind of with the pandemic, and you had a rough stretch out there where you weren't playing particularly well. You weren't making many checks. And I read you had a long drive from Miami all the way back to California, and you had to give yourself a pretty long stern talking to for that drive.
Yeah, I drove, I think it was 4 days, not a day under 10 hours. And it was a lot of quiet time where I had to really think about what I wanted to do. And it kind of came down to, I want to play professional golf, and I just had to figure out what was the best way for me to do it. And when I got home, finally, I took a few days and then spoke with my coach, and we kind of set out a plan. And it's kind of wild that this plan has led to here, because that was missing many tour cuts back 3.5 years ago.
What did that plan entail?
It was a lot of focusing on working on the right thing. So for us, that was a lot of short game wedges, understanding how to play the game better versus just full on aggression all the time or trying to be perfect. It was, how do we manage ourselves around the golf course, and how do we pretty much give us the best scoring opportunities possible?
You're about to head out onto the toughest tour in the world. Do you find yourself trying to assess where you need to get better in your game, or are you at a point where you say, you know, I'm going to trust what got me there in the first place?
I would say it's about 50-50. I'm trusting my equipment and the people around me that have gotten me there, but you can always get better. And I'm really going to focus on a lot of the scoring clubs coming up this year. And with courses being so much harder up on the PGA Tour, I feel like that's where my game will actually show a little bit more, and I'm excited to show it out there. But I'm really looking forward to the challenge and playing with the best players in the world.
How about your Korn Ferry Tour journey? You lost your card at the end of 2023. How'd that help you kind of make 2024 the year that it's been?
Yeah, I mean, losing my card last year was another one of those moments where I didn't know if I could continue or wanted to continue. But again, took a couple of days off, spoke with my coach, and we developed a plan to get back on the horse. And I only had about 3 weeks after the last event last year to get ready for first stage of Q school. And first stage all the way through, I played great, went back to some old equipment that I was using. And it was a really big change, but mentally it was the biggest shift.
Well, congratulations on earning that PGA Tour card. Look forward to meeting you in 2025. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, guys.
It's great to have Luke with us on this Tuesday. And Luke, I want to start with Augusta, Georgia, your home, with the devastation of the last week with Hurricane Helene. How are your family and friends doing?
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. You know, I'm very fortunate. The hurricane didn't, you know, completely impact me personally. We had a couple trees down and around our house and then in the street. But my family was able to get out and kind of get out of town a little bit. Obviously, most of the communities still without power and water. It was a kind of surreal thing. It almost didn't seem natural to see so many homes and so many people close to you affected directly. And you know, the whole area is still kind of reeling. And you know, to be here in kind of a normalcy of my work setting and then have home kind of so much in limbo, it's really, really challenging.
What is it like to go to work against that kind of backdrop, Luke? Because is it a distraction, what's going on at home? Or do you almost feel as though getting inside the ropes is kind of a welcome relief from what's going on in the real world?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to spin it as most positive as I can. And the direct way that I know how to do that best is by playing some good golf and giving a platform to the community that I call home. And so Henrik Norlander and myself are going to donate $500 per birdie this week for the Red Cross in Augusta, and hopefully aid some people that need it the most. And we're hopefully, you know, going to challenge some friends and family that are privileged in this area to be able to match that for us. And obviously with Florida and North Carolina and South Carolina, it kind of touches home to a lot of different people. And I know that, you know, for us locally, it's important, but it's really important throughout the Southeast to give back as well.
Luke, that's a wonderful gesture. You have a lot of perspective. You turn 40 in January. That's a big goal and milestone, not just for a golfer, for a human being. What are you most looking forward to in your 40s, and what are you reflecting on?
Yeah, I'll try not to think about the number as much, but trying to act and play like I'm younger. But yeah, I mean, there's so many good golfers that have had successful careers in their 40s and past that. And so I try to kind of bottle that a little bit and seeing what Lucas Glover and Stuart Sink and certain guys that have won well into their 40s. And, you know, the game of golf has gotten much younger and a lot more talented. So for me, it's staying as healthy as I can and trying to kind of push myself to keep improving into my 40s.
Yeah, in this game, you get squeezed by younger, talented players. But there's other ways you get squeezed as well. Luke, you were, I believe, 75th in the FedEx Cup rankings this year. You were very close to making the top 70 that makes the playoffs. It used to be 125. Are you a fan of this kind of reduced system into the playoffs, or the general squeeze that's being put on everyone who isn't at the absolute top elite level?
Yeah, it's a great question, because I feel like there's so many dynamic players across the board. And yeah, I understand for the for these elevated signature events, but I also feel like capping them at you know, 70 man fields or whatever it is very challenging. So yes, it is. It's an accomplishment to make the top 50 and then make the playoffs. But there's so many good players, and I think that starts in the fall series, seeing some of these names that will come out, you know, again and again, where some of these guys are starting their careers and it kind of will open up the doors for them to just have a great lifetime career on the PGA Tour. And other guys like myself, it gives them opportunities to play in some bigger tournaments and then keep their card in a sense too. So a lot of good storylines coming from tournaments like Sanderson Farms and continuing out throughout the fall.
Well, you're back at a place you've had success, but you also struggled at the end of the last season. You've had some time off since the Wyndham. What have you worked on specifically to kind of get your game where you want it to be?
Yeah, I kind of rested a little bit, and I feel like that was good mentally, but physically it wasn't really helping what I was trying to improve upon. So trying to put my head down and really strengthen some of my deficiencies physically, and I feel like I've done a really good job of that. So hopefully that'll lead to some good golf, but that's more long term. I feel like if I can kind of keep checking those boxes and improving a little bit here and there, then hopefully it will give me a better opportunity to go play well, you know, in the near future, but also long term.
Your win there last year, Luke, got you into some of those signature events in the early part of this season. As the season wore on, you weren't in some of those events. Do you really feel as though it kind of puts you behind the eight ball in terms of making the playoffs and even in some cases keeping cards if you're not in that inner circle playing the signatures?
Yeah, obviously, you know, if you've played well enough, you deserve to be in those events. But I definitely feel like it's a clear advantage, and I'm not sure what the breakdown will be with the numbers. But, you know, when you're in those events, a lot of those are no cut, and a lot of them obviously good money. So you feel like you have an advantage if you play well in those events to kind of give you some momentum and keep you, you know, snowballing in the right direction. So, yeah, it's clearly an obvious advantage in every level of the game. But I know that they're gearing for more of a separation between kind of within the tour, and I feel like hopefully there's a little bit of giveaway where there's still room for, you know, a majority of guys to still be able to play at a high level and play against each other more often.
Luke, you played in a couple of Palmer Cups back in the day. I'm curious how much of the President's Cup you watched and how much you burned to make one of those President's Cup or Ryder Cup teams in your 40s.
Yeah, anytime I've ever been close to, you know, doing that, I haven't really done that well that summer. And I guess you can spin it two different ways. I know a lot of guys who, you know, make it a goal of that team. It's a byproduct of playing really well. And, you know, for me, it's a little bit, I've kind of compartmentalized a little bit and just say, okay, I just want to play well each tournament. And usually when I do that, I kind of can extend the period a little bit longer of some good golf. So yeah, it'd be awesome to play in that. Obviously, some of my peers and friends have, you know, been on some winning teams, and, you know, it looks like the most fun you'll ever have, you know, playing with some of your buddies and you know, taking down the opponent, and then coming out with the trophy. Obviously, it was really cool to see Jim and those guys be victorious again.
How much time do you spend, Luke, thinking about the broader politics of the game in terms of whether or not there will be a deal between the tour and the Saudis? Is that a topic of conversation among guys in the locker room much?
Yeah, it's been pretty continuous. I try to shelter myself a little bit. I'm trying to, you know, prolong my career, not shorten it by stressing about that. You know, we get asked a lot about it when we're home, you know, by a lot of, you know, friends, family, just people that are, you know, fans of the game. And it's tough. It's a tough time. I feel like it's sad for the fans not seeing their favorite players all playing against each other more often. And, you know, hopefully there'll be an answer for that. But I don't know. We don't. Obviously, the tour is doing a better job of communicating, but I just don't really know if I or see an immediate answer to that right now.
Well, you have a lot of business to take care of this week in your title defense. Luke, thanks for the time and, more importantly, what you're doing to help the people of the Southeast.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
And Patton joins us now. Patton, I don't get to ask this question very often, so I have to start with it. Tree hugging? I know you did it at Napa on the way to victory as part of a mental exercise. Does it work? Because if it does work, I'll go out there and hug a whole forest at this point.
Oh, man. Yeah, I guess it does work. Wow. Sorry about that. Yeah, I guess it does work. We've done a lot of stuff that I'm a little uncomfortable with, and it seems to have worked pretty well.
Patton, I've been interviewing athletes for almost 30 years, and to find a mental coach to work on that aspect of the game, to be kinder, gentler, more playful, it takes some humbling to do. How did you even get to that point where you felt comfortable enough to reach out and try to become more playful and help that side of the game?
Yeah, you know, it helps to not take things so seriously, to be a kid again, to just really find some joy in life and enjoy in what you're doing. It's easy to get a little too serious out here and get down on yourself and not be able to stay clear-headed. I think doing a lot of that stuff helped me stay clear and determined, and I was very focused that week.
You won a couple of times back in the 2017-2018 season, Patton, and then you had to wait 6 years for this victory. What was the frustration like during that period for you?
A lot of frustration. I felt like I was underachieving for quite some time, and it wore on me. It hurt my confidence. I knew it was still there. I knew I was capable and wanted to play well so badly, but was in my own way. And to be able to get a little bit more clear-minded and get organized and disciplined, and those are the things that really helped me play my best in Napa. And it's a lot more fun that way, and you feel a little bit more in control of yourself, or a lot more in control of yourself. It helps you perform, and that was a lot of fun.
The picture of you in the tree, I can't get over it. What was that conversation like? Like, how did you and your mental coach decide upon the tree? I mean, you could have hugged your caddy or a volunteer. Like, what was the connection with the tree in nature? A lot of trees in Napa, obviously.
Yeah. She wanted me to do little fun things, little grounding tactics, playful things each day, and hugging a tree was the assignment that day, and I wasn't going to argue with her, so I found a good-looking tree and gave it a big old hug.
I think you went on and shot 65 that day as well, so it definitely worked that day. Patton, you work with Justin Parsons a lot on your swing. You're a big guy. You're, what, 6'5"? What kind of tendencies do you have with your swing that you kind of have to be wary of when you are that far away from the ball?
Yeah, Justin and I have done a lot of great work. He's been really instrumental in my development, and we've improved my swing, and my ball striking has gotten better over the years, and I still was not performing. My strength has always been my putting, and I wasn't putting well. But for a tall guy, it's really important to stay in your posture, have the strength and core stability to stay in your posture, and that's something that my trainer and I, David Richardson, have been working hard on, and it's allowed Justin and I to make some improvements, and you know, my mindset coach has allowed me to get out of my own way a little bit, and it's all just added up to some better golf.
Yeah, that Sea Island Performance Center is no joke. I just saw Randy Myers, by the way, up in Montreal. He was part of Jim Furyk's staff. You know, whenever somebody wins on the PGA Tour, it's always about what's next. How do your goals change? But how do they change, or do you kind of keep things in perspective? You know, how do you stay in the precious present without looking too far ahead?
Yeah, I set my goal for the fall to finish 51st on the money list, which is as high as you possibly can finish in my position. So my goal hadn't changed. That was just a step towards that goal, and I'm looking forward to moving up and finishing 51st.
You're also going back to Augusta National for the Masters, Patton. What does that feel like? It's been a couple of years since you've played a major championship. It's been 5 years since you've gone down Magnolia Lane. You got to be looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm eager to get back. My last time there, I played fairly well with not nearly the game or the confidence that I have now. I think I maybe finished 22nd or 18th. It was my best major finish last time at Augusta. So I'm looking forward to getting back and trying it again and taking what I've learned and applying it there.
Well, you are the only guy who can do a clean sweep of the FedEx Cup fall schedule right now. We're looking forward to seeing you trying that this week. Good luck, Patton.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Wade Cummins, born and raised in Oklahoma, the first four-time All-American in program history, played for the U.S. on the 2019 and 20 Palmer Cup and the 21 Walker Cup, turned pro in 21, and of course, earning that PGA Tour card via the Korn Ferry Tour. Quade joins us now from Indiana. Congratulations, first of all. You're from Oklahoma. I was doing some research. 6'3", 230. The bio said occupation athlete. You're burly. How did the football coach not get a hold of you at OU?
Yeah, you know, during workouts and stuff, they were in there all the time. They liked watching the golfers work out. We were putting up some weight, and we didn't have a golf team that looked like golfers, I'll say that.
Wow.
You've played pretty consistently well all year, Quade. Was there a particular point in the season where you felt as though you could exhale, that you'd done enough to get over the line and secure this tour card?
Not really. You know, everybody's out there trying to, you know, you're trying to get your number as high as you can. Obviously, number one's already locked up with Matt McCarty, and he gets the U.S. Open and Players. So I know last year there was a big, you know, beginning of the year, some guys towards that middle top 15-ish didn't get into some events. So you really can't let up out here. You're trying to play as good as you can every tournament and can't really let off the gas, really.
You said when you showed up for college, you were a cocky kid who quickly got whooped on by better players. Are you expecting the same kind of thing when you get to the PGA Tour?
Luckily for me, I get to go back home and play with a lot of PGA Tour players at Oaktree National. So I'm used to seeing the PGA Tour pros, you know, Austin Eckroat, Chris Goddard, Victor Hovland. So, you know, getting to see those guys day in, day out when we're home is pretty special. And I know it's a privilege and not very many people get to experience that. So, you know, hopefully I can kind of lean on those guys to, you know, not guide me, but, you know, let me play with them and hang out with them next year.
Half dozen top tens this season. Was there an aha moment for you in your game? Why are things coming together so beautifully right now?
Yeah, I think this is my third full year out here. So, you know, seeing a lot of the same courses, knowing what to expect when you show up week to week is definitely, it's nice to have in your back pocket to, you know, just kind of know what the conditions are, you know, typically going to be like week to week, being there, you know, your third time around most places. So, you know, just kind of going through your routine and, you know, if putts are going in, it's definitely nice.
There have been some concerns, Quade, that the Korn Ferry Tour graduates haven't had as easy a time getting starts on tour over the last year or so because of the signature events. There's really a pressure on the amount of playing spots week to week out there on tour. Has that entered your mind at all, or are you just going to kind of take it as it comes when you start the year?
I think you just got to play as good as you can and see what that gets you. I know a few guys, you know, you get off to a nice start and you get to go play Pebble and Riviera. So, I mean, that's for sure a goal. You know, we'll see how things shake out, but you just got to play as good as you can and, you know, put the work in and, you know, get it going on Thursday.
I watched this video and it showed you kind of working through a clubhouse and you were eating some salmon and kind of showing what the Corn Ferry Tour life was like. What was that all about? I loved it. You bring a lot of personality to the table.
Yeah, that was in Chicago, my rookie season. They have, I don't know how many rooms they have at the Glen Club, but I was staying at the Glen Club that week and they asked me to do a video of kind of, you know, it was kind of my house kind of thing. So, you know, walking down the dining below, you know, straight above, I was staying there the whole week. So that's kind of what that was all about.
Now, you've played a handful of PGA Tour events, Quade. You spend, as you mentioned, a lot of time around tour players. Do you have a sense that there are particular aspects of your game that you need to work on to hang with those guys next year?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's just another level up kind of thing. You know, you'd like to get a little better in every part of your game. You know, those courses are a little longer than what we're used to. So a lot more mid irons rather than wedges. But other than that, I'm just looking to, you know, feel like I'm continuously getting better throughout my career.
Now, you talked about being from Oklahoma and the guys that you practice with. Do you feel like you will go out on the PGA Tour? Well, those guys are going to try to take your lunch, no question about it, but that you have a group of guys you can kind of lean on to have dinner with, practice rounds, like just a little group that you have, so it's not such a daunting thing to have that tour card and not know necessarily where you're going.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I'm pretty lucky having two of my best friends out on tour. You know, hopefully they'll take me in and let me stay with them and, you know, Airbnbs and go out to dinner and stuff like that. I know Austin's playing signature events all next year, but hopefully we'll get to play in a handful of events and, you know, it's exciting. So I'm looking forward to it.
You came out of one of the early PGA Tour University classes, Quade. I think you finished sixth, which back then was good enough to get you a card on what was then PGA Tour Canada, now PGA Tour Americas. The benefits are obviously a little better for guys who finish sixth now than when you did it. But how important was that as a pathway for you to get straight into competitive golf at the top level?
Yeah, for sure. That was something huge. You know, I kind of look at everything happens for a reason. If, you know, COVID doesn't happen, I'm not in that PGA Tour U class. And then kind of how things shook out with what followed my first year as a professional. It was huge. If I don't have that status, I don't know if I would be here on the Corn Ferry Tour getting a PGA Tour card. So I'm very thankful that, you know, everything happened the way it did. And I'm looking forward to, you know, starting next year on the PGA Tour.
Well, I hope you make another My House video on the PGA Tour. A lot of great clubhouses and great eats on the road, as you might have heard. Congratulations. We'll speak to you down the road.
Thank you.